They say, the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:05, Wednesday, June 29th. This is the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. It's been a major bummer to live in America recently, but I hope everybody has a happy and safe 4th anyway.
You know, I'm kind of down too, Joe. Last night, my Red Sox lost in Toronto because our closer refused to get the vaccine and couldn't travel up there. And we had to pitch a scrub who got killed in the 9th inning. Personal freedom's my you-know-what. Do it for the team, fellas. God damn it.
Wait, who is that that's talking? We didn't even get an intro.
Oh, yeah, that's me, Bill Finley. That's right.
I'm just Red Sox guy now.
Yeah, exactly. For those of you who are actually listening to the podcast as opposed to viewing it, we want to make sure that you get attributed to your quality work, Bill.
You got it.
Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable. And guys, even though we've been doing this for over 2 years, according to the criteria posted by the American Graded Stakes Committee, we still wouldn't be eligible for a graded stakes promotion yet.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Make plans to attend the Keeneland September Yearling Sale beginning Monday, September 12th. You can learn more at theworldsyearlingsale.com. All right, so we got some news to get to today, which we're going to get to a little bit later, including a resolution on the Bob Baffert Naira kerfuffle, finally. But we wanted to talk about this off the top because this was in Bill's Week in Review, and it generated a lot of discussion, a lot of buzz. And honestly, Bill, with his Week in Reviews, has honestly seemed like I'm his ghostwriter recently because he's saying all of this stuff that I love and that just hits me right in the heart. I feel like kind of like you remember the movie Ghost, where Patrick Swayze is like moving the pen. I feel like I'm Patrick Swayze in this instance. But no, he was writing about how there's too many graded stakes races, too many stakes races. Let me go to the glasses for this. I just want to quote him. They can only scrape together a field of four for Saturday's Mother Goose at Belmont, run 2 weeks after they had a field of four for the Acorn. And then Saturday's third race at Belmont Fair, no better. Only four went in the Wild Applause Stakes, three of them trained by Chad Brown. It's not just a Naira problem. The number of stakes run across the country that have attracted five horses or fewer is alarming. Since May 7th, the Derby Day, there have been 21 graded or listed races that had five horse fields. A list that includes some of the biggest races on the calendar, like the Met Mile, the Ogden Phipps, the Hollywood Gold Cup. Six more graded stakes consisted of just four runners. It's a major problem, and it's something that the industry does not seem like it's going to address anytime soon. But Bill is 1,000% right. There's too many races, too many graded stakes races, and it's an unbettable product. Now, the problem is, to me at least, that people are still going to bet it because it's Belmont Park, it's Churchill Downs, it's the major tracks, and people are still going to line up and bet those horses. Unfortunately, I think this is a problem that is not going to get solved anytime soon. But that's why we're bringing it up on this very show to maybe try to gather some momentum and some buzz. Bill, would you care to expand on your article?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it, Joe. The racing industry has not addressed this and has not addressed it at all. And what I tried to do was put some numbers to back up what is going on here. And I picked 2007 because that was 15 years ago, nice round number. There were 34,000 foals. This year, there'll be about 17,000. So the foal crop is down 50%. So I'm not saying that the number of stakes should be down 50%, but it certainly should be down significantly. I mean, you can't have half as many foals and run as many stakes races. The amount of graded stakes races in the country is, and the number of grade ones is down in both categories about 5%. So this is the problem. And it's very obvious there are too many stakes races and there are not enough horses to fill the races. And it's going to, as the foal crop continues to go down, as horses run less and less, this is a problem that's only going to get worse all the time. And, you know, there's two problems here and two areas that need to be addressed. One is the Graded Stakes Committee. They should have taken a bomb to this, blown it up, gotten rid of dozens, if not even 100 or so graded stakes races. Threes go to listed, twos go to threes, ones go to two, et cetera. They haven't done a single thing. So a graded stakes race today is not at all the equivalent of a graded stakes race of 15 years ago. And especially when you get broodmares in there trying to get black type, you run third in a grade three in a five horse field. What if you really accomplish it? You get that same black type. Now, I went so far as also to say, you know, what would be wrong of just getting rid of some of these races? And look, you know, it would be a little bit of a tough love, but I brought up the Mother Goose. That race has no place on the Naira calendar. 2 weeks after the Acorn, comes on top of the coaching club at Saratoga. It's a recipe for disaster. It's a $250,000 grade two race. Just get rid of it. Put the $250,000 into the Acorn, make that a $750,000 race, and make it a mile and eighth, and you solved your problem right there. I realize that's a tough thing to suggest. Nobody's going to say, oh boy, I can't wait to get rid of a bunch of stakes races. But don't we have to do something?
And Bill, I loved your article, and there were a lot of points in there that are indisputable and are just facts. I mean, you know, quite frankly, you mentioned a lot of them as far as the way the trends are going for foals. The crop, you know, the crop size is decreasing every year. And you wonder, you know, at some points, and we've talked about it a lot, why are some of these races graded? Why wouldn't they downgrade it? And there's a whole process and criteria where if you ever wanted to look it up on toba.org, there's you know, voluminous information as far as what the criteria is. And they have kind of a platform and a formula on how to do it. Now, that being said, there are too many races. There are too many stake races. There are too many graded stake races. And I think, you know, we can talk about that ad nauseum. It's not going to change, though, unfortunately, because from the breeding standpoint, the lifeblood of the breeding industry are black type. Whenever you look at a catalog page, the first thing that somebody's going to say is, well, where's the black type? How much black type does this family have? How many stake winners? How many stake runners, et cetera? How many graded stake winners? Now, that is putting the burden on people who are buying the horses now, where they actually have to do a little more homework. It used to be 15 years ago, Bill and Joe, where, you know, if a horse ran third in a grade three, that was legitimate. It was probably an 8 or 10 horse field. The horse probably had to really work hard in order to place in a graded stake race, and it earned that grade three, grade two, grade one, stamp. Nowadays, where we're talking about all these graded stake races, and there's four horse fields, you really just have to beat the ambulance in order to be, you know, graded stakes placed. Do a lot of people look at that when they look at the Keeneland September sale? Do they look to see how many horses were in the race? No. Do they look to see what kind of buyer number or sheet number the horse ran in order to finish first, second, or third? No. Why? Because it's too hard. It's extra work that they have to do. So shame on them for not doing the extra work. We talk about the Mother Goose in particular because the timing of the race is terrible in comparison to where some of these other races are. That being said, I'm just going to be a little contrarian. And you look at the four horses that ran in the race. Gerrymander, who won the race, finished second in the grade one in the Frisette as a two-year-old. Shahama was a grade three winner, albeit overseas, but a grade three winner. Juju's Map won the Alcibiades as a two-year-old. And Venti Valentine, was second by a neck in the Demoiselle in the grade two. So of the four horses that actually ran, I don't think you can make the case that these weren't legitimate graded stakes fillies. That's just kind of a quinky-dink in my estimation. If we looked at other races, you could find a lot of bad horses that are running in there that are hoping to get third place and hoping to get black type. Again, to go back to the Mother Goose, Gerrymander ran a 95 buyer, which if you look at other, I know it's only one criteria, but if you look at other graded stake races for three-year-old fillies going long, a 95 buyer would put you in contention for the majority of them. So this particular race, this particular group of horses in this particular race probably isn't a great example, but I can't argue, against what you guys are saying as far as there are way too many. There are way too many. We don't need to have four horse fields in general. It doesn't do the public any good. Doesn't do the bettors any good. It certainly doesn't do the racetracks any good. Nobody wants to run these races with four or five horse fields. But until the membership of the American Graded Stakes Committee, you know, until they're not composed of six breeders, most of them Kentucky breeders, none of this is ever going to change. Nobody's going to take away the graded status after they've earned it. Even though we all agree and we've all talked about it ad nauseum, that a lot of these graded stake races just are really glorified allowance races.
Can I be the next campaign is to get John on the American Graded Stakes Committee after the Breeders' Cup Board? Oh, wait, he's a breeder, too. So I don't think we can trust John to fix this thing either. But, you know, honestly, it's not so much that the Mother Goose had terrible horses. It's just that those horses should have been the Acorn, and we should have had a 9 or 10 horse field in the Acorn instead of the 4-horse field in the Acorn and then the 4-horse field. And the Mother Goose, and that's the other thing. It's not just that, you know, as Bill mentions, the foal crop is so far down. It's 50% when it was almost 50, like 15, 20 years ago. It's that the calendar is lined up with a training methods that don't exist anymore. You know, the calendar is such that you could have a horse running back in 3-4 weeks, you know, and actually make these fields a little bit bigger, but trainers aren't going to do that anymore. So not only are we misaligned with the foal crop size, we're misaligned with the way that trainers actually train and run their horses. So we're two in the hole, I think, in terms of trying to structure this schedule to line up with, you know, the modern day racing. And the other thing is, like, you know, Bill says you could put the $250,000 into the Acorn purse, or you could just put it into the overnight and beef up allowances and maiden races, because those are the races that I think in general are going to get more field size and get more people to bet on them. I think the main issue is that these fields are unbettable. Like if you're just a fan and you're not really a racing bettor, you probably don't even care. You're probably like, why are these guys starting the show complaining about this problem that I, you know, doesn't really affect me at all? But if you're a bettor and you open up the Saturday PPs at Belmont, and there's a bunch of stakes races, and you see 4 horses, 5 horses, 6 horses. It happened all winter at Santa Anita. Same thing. It's depressing, and it makes you not want to bet those cards. So I think, you know, that problem is going to come crashing in eventually, I think. You know, maybe. Like, I kind of actually hope the handle goes down on some of these big cards where they cannot get these fields bigger than 5 or 6 horses, because that's the only way I think it gets rectified, is if people stop betting these cards and, you know, go bet like Canterbury or, you know, Indiana or one of these tracks that has full fields and low takeout. But I understand obviously the allure of betting these star studded fields at Belmont and Saratoga. But I worry with Saratoga coming up, you know, we're all going to be excited for Saratoga. We're going to talk about it a bunch. We're going to bet it. But I just worry in some of these cards and some of these stakes races, the field sizes we're going to get. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Greatest Stakes winning Keeneland sales grads from this past weekend include the Grade 2 Mother Goose winner Gerrymander, Grade 3 Ohio Derby winner Tony Port, and Grade 3 Chicago Handicap winner Lady Rocket. So that's a sweep. There were 3 Grade Stakes over the weekend. Keeneland sales grads swept them. Before Keeneland hosts the Breeders' Cup World Championships for the third time, the track's annual fall meet will offer 22 stakes worth a record $8.75 million. The 17-day season kicks off on October 7th. Will open with 11 stakes, 9 of which are part of the Breeders' Cup Winning Year In Series during its 3-day Fall Stars weekend. Cannot wait for that. Fall meet public ticket sales will begin August 16th. And to learn more, you can go to tickets.keeneland.com. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
Spitestown. Munnings. Echo Town.
It's Echo Town for Joe Palomo and Echo Town raced away.
And Echo Town is drawing away in the stretch. Echo Town wins the Allen Jerkin Stakes.
A sire line so prolific, it repeats itself. Echo Town.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Coolmore. Triple Crown winner Justify had a Sunday double this weekend. First, he got his first stakes winner when Statuette won the Group 2 Early Stud Stakes at the Curragh. And then later at Churchill Downs, Prove Right won a maiden special weight. Justify now has 2 stakes performers and 4 winners from just 8 starters, so obviously off to a great start. And also this weekend, fellow Triple Crown winner American Pharoah had his 30th stakes winner when his daughter Reframe won the listed Paradise Stakes in Tokyo on Sunday. And then Uncle Mo scored his 11th TDN Rising Star with Summer Promise, who was a debut winner at Churchill for Dwayne Lucas. I think American Pharoah has 5 Grade 1 winners now as well, so he's obviously killing it. You know, him and Constitution are at the top of that star-studded fourth crop sire list. And American Pharoah, you know, you expected him to be, I think, to be a good sire because of the quality of mares he's gotten, but I think he's even exceeded the expectations, which is hard to do as the first Triple Crown winner to retire to stud in 30 some odd years. It's honestly super impressive, I think, what he's been able to do on both turf and dirt. So those Pharoah babies going to keep running big.
Hey Joe, how about the fact that they just announced that American Pharoah and Justify have been bred to so many mares, are so popular here in the States, that they're not sending them Southern Hemisphere this year. They're not sending them to Australia. because they want to make sure that those horses are really potent for next year's opening breeding season. I mean, if that doesn't, scream how popular they are, I don't know what does.
Yeah. And it was honestly, when I read that news, I was thinking back to when I was at Ashford, when Katie and I went and they brought out one Triple Crown winner, they brought out another Triple Crown winner. I was like, yo, this is special. This is a very special moment. All right, so like I said in the open, we finally got a resolution to the whole Bob Baffert and Naira scrum. If you remember, it goes all the way back to last May. It was around the time of the Preakness last year when Naira first suspended Bob Baffert indefinitely after the whole Medina Spirit controversy. There was a lot of legal back and forth. Eventually, the case went to a hearing officer who was a retired New York State Supreme Court justice. He recommended a 2-year suspension, and then last week, a 3-member panel came back with a 1-year suspension for Bob Baffert at Naira, 365 days. Now he was given credit for time served for the suspensions that Naira gave him in the first place, which I think ended up being like 2 months before it got reversed by a judge. And then also the suspension that he's currently serving, which was handed down by the KHRC. So in the end, he's going to be eligible to run at Naira tracks again next January 23rd. So in effect, it's only about six or seven months from now. There's not a ton to say about that. I really enjoyed the break. I enjoyed the reprieve from the Bob Baffert news that we've had for like the last couple of months. I vowed on this show that we weren't going to talk about him or any of the legal issues. But this time the news came crashing through a little bit. I think we can all move on now, guys. Can we all just, can Bob Baffert just accept his penalty? Move on. He's going to come back this summer, probably win a bunch of stakes, probably going to win the Haskell again. In the end, it was a very limited interruption to his business. Now, the Naira thing is a little bit of a bigger deal. But at the end of the day, how many racing days is he really going to miss in New York because of this punishment? Even if he comes back in January, he's not going to run a horse in New York for another 4 months after that. So Bill reported on this story. I'll let him expand on it.
Yeah, it's interesting, Joe. And finally, all this Baffert stuff is starting to wind down. There's very little left that hasn't been adjudicated or resolved. And I believe it's Sunday. His 90-day suspension is up. So come Sunday morning, he can roll through the gates of Santa Anita and be back in business as usual, at least in Southern California. But what I thought, you hit on all the points of the news. But what I thought was interesting here was that, Baffert's team obviously wanted to be given a full, exoneration. You get nothing. Sorry, sir. We this was terrible. We never should have suspended you. And, go on with the rest of your life and you can come back to Naira tomorrow. That was never going to happen. But what was interesting here, this was the closest Baffert came to any victory in any one of these. I mean, he's 0 for the world in all these lawsuits, appeals, et cetera. So Peter Sherwood, the hearing officer, I mean, he went crazy on Baffert in his report. Matter of fact, he said Baffert is engaged in a pattern and practice of unlawful conduct that has no parallel in modern history of thoroughbred racing. He continually used the word doping, even though these were overages of therapeutic medications. That in and of itself is not really the exact same thing as doping. So I give the panel, the three people that were assembled to give the final verdict on this, I give them credit for not rubber stamping what the judge, the hearing officer wanted, and presumably what Naira wanted too. They cut the suspension down from 2 years to 1 year. And so far as that thing he said about the worst pattern of unlawful conduct, they said there is scant support in the record for such a statement. So they thought outside the box. They didn't rubber stamp it. And again, and when it all it's all said and done, what did Baffert really miss in New York? A couple things coming up. I mean, he probably would have had a horse maybe in the Travers and something else at Saratoga. But that wasn't really nearly the suspension with the kind of teeth that the Derby suspension, the Churchill Downs suspension has, which will keep him out of next year's Derby as well. But yeah, we're getting close. I think we can look forward to circle a date on the calendar as of maybe September 1st. Never have to talk about this again.
John doesn't even want to talk about it now.
Yeah.
I'm just beside myself. We've spoken about this ad nauseum. I'm disappointed that he's going to have horses in the Haskell, but I am glad that we are able to kind of move forward and now just focus on the summer of racing as opposed to the summer of scandal.
Totally. Yeah. No, I was like I said, the Law and Order segment that we have been doing for the past year or so, thanks to Bob Baffert and his lawyers, is hopefully long gone. Well, that was the only interesting thing about the
story. Wait, we're not done yet, because right around the corner, Jason Service's trial, baby.
Well, but that's juicy. Like, yeah, I feel like that's going to be juicy. You know?
We don't want to say juicy. No juice, man.
No, no pun intended. But that's gonna be exciting and scandalous. I think the Bob Averett legal stuff was boring as shit, and I hated going back and forth about it every single week. That was the only interesting thing about the story to me, is that Bob Averett's lawyers were still complaining. Like the 3-member panel reduced by half the recommended suspension, and they still were like, he's getting railroaded. They're just jealous of all of Bob Averett's success. Like, yo, just shut up. Just take your medicine. For once, but you know, thankfully we won't have to talk about them for a long time. But if I don't hear Craig Robertson's name again forever, I'll be pleased.
This segment of Trainers Behaving Badly brought to you by Wyatt Tarrant & Combs.
Oh, we've got more trainers behaving badly. Don't you worry. Right around the corner. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by the Pennsylvania Horse Breeders Association. Last weekend, 2021, Pennsylvania, I've been waiting for this news. I've been waiting for this note. The Pennsylvania Bred Horse of the Year of 2021, Chub Wagon, kicked off her 2022 season with a win in the Power by Far Stakes at Parks. Last year, the daughter of Hey Chub won 6 Pennsylvania Bred Stakes races. I think she's got a big, big year ahead of her now, especially now that Gamine is in her way. She can take her mantle as the top sprinter in the land. It was great to see her back. Pennsylvania Day at the Races is Monday, August 22nd. The card features a full day of PA bred racing, including 7 $100,000 stakes races and the first 2 2-year-old Stallion Series races, which we've talked about before on this show. Registered 2022 PHBA members can enjoy a free day at the races, including lunch, giveaways, and raffles. So definitely make plans to head to Parks on Monday, August 22nd. It'll be a great day. You know, you'll get the whole racing landscape to yourself. A dark day for Saratoga. Parks is the place to be on August 22nd. And yeah, definitely nominate if you still can for those PA bred, PA sired stakes. Going to be a lot of money given away to Pennsylvania breds. PHBA always doing great initiatives like that. And we'll be right back after this message from the PHBA. Go Chub Wagon.
The PA Horse Breeders Association introduces the Pennsylvania Stallion Series. 4 brand new races to be run at Parks for PA-sired, PA-bred 2-year-olds. There are 2 $100,000 contests on August 22nd, PA Day at the Races. September 24th, PA Derby Day, has 2 more races, each with a $200,000 purse. The PA Stallion Series, yet another reason why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race. For more, please visit PABred.com.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. You can learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we're thrilled to bring on this week, all the way from Hong Kong. He's an executive at the Hong Kong Jockey Club, but he's leaving to become the CEO of the Thoroughbred Owners of California. Bill Nader, thanks for coming on.
Great to be here.
Great to talk to you. We appreciate you making time in the middle of a race card. Very well dressed for the occasion, as you would assume. All right. So you're a guy, and you used to be the COO of NYRA. You're a guy who's accomplished enough in the industry that I feel like you could basically write your own ticket and get any job you wanted. So basically, why did you choose to come back to America to head the TOC?
Well, Joe, I was coming back anyway. I had made the decision to leave at some point this year. I was going to stay through December, so I could get in the Hong Kong International races, you know, the flagship day, the big event here, which I really love. But when word trickled around that I was going to head home, you know, in Hong Kong, we've been pretty much locked down for the last 3 years. So I haven't been back for 3 years. My family would come over to visit from time to time, but they haven't been able to do that. So I was ready to wrap it up and head home. And then this opportunity presented itself. And you know, through the process of getting to know the board at the TOC, I became very comfortable with their commitment, their dedication, and the fact that they've, you know, soldiered on without a CEO for a number of months now and kept it warm for me, I think is something that I really appreciate, because I know it's not easy for them. And the compromise was that I would start in October, so Hong Kong can find people to kind of come in and fill the void, and I can leave here. You know, I've had a good run over here. I love it over here. You know, in Hong Kong, if you're anybody in horse racing. The one thing about Hong Kong is, in many ways, like Saratoga or maybe a Del Mar, it's relevant every single day. And it's not just that it's relevant, it's a way of life. So leaving here is never easy, because if you love the sport, you have to love it here. It's just terrific. But again, when the opportunity presented itself and I got to know the board a little bit, and not that I'm a California guy, I'm certainly not, but I'm very familiar with the, you know, the rich history of racing in California. And if you look at recent years, even now with Flightline, who may be the world number one when the world rankings come out next month, or he'll be close to it. When you think of horses like Arrogate, Zenyatta, California Chrome, Best Pal, you go all the way back to Seabiscuit. It's a rich, rich, rich history. And you have some of the world's most beautiful racetracks. Great weather. So there's so much to build on there. And I'm excited for the opportunity.
Hey, Bill, welcome. It's good to talk to you, especially with our Red Sox now flourishing and on their way up into the standings. And everything is great in Red Sox Nation. Bill is a native of the Granite State, New Hampshire, and a longtime Red Sox fan. Issues in California. Purses are not great, especially when you compare them to New York, Arkansas, Kentucky. The racing schedules, there's less and less racing all the time. Short fields. Are those some of the things you want to tackle? What are what's on your laundry list of things that you want to roll up your sleeves and say, hey, what can I do to make things better here?
Well, you know, it's something I'm going to really take a deep dive into when I get there. But just scratching the surface, when you look at purse money in California, they don't have the advantage in California of alternative gaming, you know, secondary support to the purse structure. So I think they've done a fairly good job of maintaining purses and keeping it at a level that's respectable, but maybe sports wagering is on the horizon there. That's something we'll have to look at. I know they've been looking at it for the last several months. Maybe that can be something new to help the prize money, the purse money. As far as field sizes, I mean, that's something that doesn't plague just California. That's, you know, across the country. But certainly bigger field sizes, potentially more grass races. I think the two things in racing, and this isn't California, it's not America, it's worldwide. The two segments you really want to make sure you take care of are horse owners and horse players. If you get those two things right, then the foundation is solid, and the whole industry and all the stakeholders that depend on racing can flourish if those two segments are strong. So we'll look at it. It will take a real deep look into it. I'm not going to pretend I'm an expert on California racing, because there's a lot going on there. And I've taken a look at it since we've been talking to the TLC and learned a little bit more and more. But once I get there and hit the ground, I'll pick it up pretty quickly. But it's a big portfolio of groups and a lot going on that makes it tick. But certainly field sizes, like anywhere else, is probably one of the core issues. And looking, trying to identify ways to find cost efficiencies, trying to find, identify areas you can make an improvement to really improve the value proposition for owners, but also for the industry at large. I think if you can make things better, it's not just for one segment, it's for everybody. It's, you know, and I think that those are the things that we're going to need to look at.
Yeah, and in typical fashion, Bill Finley's looking at a glass half empty. Bill, I'm going to look at a glass half full, and that is, let's talk a little bit about California's improved safety record. I know that animal welfare is near and dear to your heart. Let's talk a little bit about what you see as far as California and how they've improved their safety record, and what other things you're going to implement or suggest to try to make things safer in California.
Well, absolutely unbelievable! What a turnaround, and people at Santa Anita should be applauded for that winter spring season. I mean, that is an incredible achievement. You know, we'll look at everything and we'll try to look at what we do here and maybe, you know, best practices around the world and really roll up our sleeves. But I think, you know, we're walking in now to a good situation in California, because that is an absolute remarkable achievement. What they did there. And I think that, reading in the TDN the other day, what Dr. Parkin had to say from the Bristol Veterinary School about Lasix, and, when you talk about sudden death, that now there's enough of a sample size to compare horses that were using Lasix and those that were not in the big decline in sudden death. So I think we'll take a look at everything. But I think that the nucleus is already in place there, because what they've achieved in 2022 is nothing short of remarkable.
I wanted to broaden the conversation out a little bit, because as you talked about before, Hong Kong is an incredibly successful racing jurisdiction, and you've had a big part in that. I read that, when you first started in 2006, Hong Kong handle was $60 billion. Last year was $133 billion. So basically, how did you guys do it? And what lessons, if any, can be drawn from that for increasing handle in American racing?
Well, I think it comes down, Joe, to quality control, number one. I mean, you want to have, what I had said earlier, you keep horse owners happy and keep horse players happy, then you're on your way. Here, we've made tremendous investment in, increasing prize money along with the increase in handle, which has helped to drive that. But one of the things here that's probably unique to Hong Kong is, and this predates me, so I take no credit for this, the illegal market was quite strong, and the Jockey Club instituted a rebate strategy for big customers that bet into the Hong Kong pools here in Hong Kong. As long as you're a Hong Kong resident and have a Hong Kong bank account, if you were to make a bet of 10,000 or more in Hong Kong dollars per race on a win, place, quinella, or quinella place bet, and if it was a losing bet only, not a winning bet, but a losing bet only, you're entitled to a 10 or 12% rebate. And that helped drive money back from the legal market to bet responsibly through Hong Kong. And that's important for all of Hong Kong, because Hong Kong Jockey Club is the biggest single taxpayer in Hong Kong. So biggest employer, biggest taxpayer, and it helps keep the tax rate low in Hong Kong. So channeling that money responsibly through the club not only gives back to the community and keeping the tax rate low, but it also helps in that Hong Kong Jockey Club is one of the top 10 charity donors in the world. So as you look around Hong Kong at education, hospitals, arts, you can see the incredible mark that Hong Kong Jockey Club has on society here in the community. But I mean, that was one thing. We talk about prize money, field size. When you look at the fundamentals of what makes a good horse racing is in the sporting and wagering entertainment business. And when you look at really what makes it attractive to the horse player, and this is really where it all comes down, when you know you have that engine cranked up and you're really moving along at 100%, is you want to have, good field sizes, quality racing, great liquidity, and then you want to have integrity. And with the integrity, we have our own racing lab right at Sha Tin, one of the world best racing labs. Our stipendary stewards, our racing stewards, are very good, and they're vigilant in protecting not only the integrity of the sport, but the integrity of the wager. So, and there's also a vertical integration here within the Jockey Club framework and the structure, where everything is, under our roof. So there's no outside interference. I mean, we not only put on the racing, but the government has no say really in anything we do in terms of regulation. They trust it all to the Jockey Club. We make application, of course, for our race dates and what races we will bring in for simulcast, and I'll do that with Home Affairs. But we have a very good working relationship on that level. Everything else they leave to us in terms of regulating the sport. So we're not only the operator, we're the regulator. We do our own food and beverage. We do our own tote. We do our own broadcasting. Everything is jockey. There's no outside vendors and no freelancers coming in to help us in the conduct of putting on a race meeting. So, we've got the people. I mean, the people who work here in the key positions are among the best in the world. And so, everything structurally is in a great spot. So, when we look at transitioning to California, I think there's going to be a lot of strengths to build on there too. And I can see it mainly through, you know, the quality of the racetracks, what they've done in safety. You know, they've got some skilled players there too. So we'll build on that, try to bring people together. And as always, anything you do to try to go forward, you got to do it as a unit. So we'll try to, you know, build consensus, get people on the right page, and try to find and identify areas that we can improve the sport, not only for the horse owners, but for the entire industry.
Bill, I don't know if this is the case or not, but are there any parallels between how racing is run in Hong Kong and what we're getting towards the end of this week with the beginning of the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Authority, Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act? Any lessons that the HSA people can look at Hong Kong as a template, say, hey, this is things they're doing right there. We want to be able to bring those practices to the U.S.
Well, one of the things, and I've read a lot in TDN about what HISA's been doing, but I think, you know, international harmonization is a big thing. I would think that, especially when it comes to the wagering component, I think it's great if the sport can agree on, you know, policies that would impact the outcome of the race with rules that are universal. But I think that some of the things here, like the lab here, is just tremendous. We do screening of all horses the day of the race day. So literally right at the last minute, we have a screening to know if there's anything that we should be aware of. And then, of course, we do the post-race testing. We do out-of-competition testing. So a lot of those things are similar. I think the difference would be the pre-race testing here. But that's something where the Jockey Club probably has the resources to do that. I think in terms of things that we've talked about, even with California, I'm not sure that this can work, but there's a pharmacy on the race course here. So for a veterinarian to get any medication that he or she will administer on a horse, and we have our own veterinarians, no outside veterinarians, they have to get it from the pharmacy, Jockey Club pharmacy. So we're controlling everything as much as we can. I'm not sure how much of this can be duplicated, but not just Hong Kong, really, the different countries, everyone taking best practices and coming together. And maybe HISA can be a catalyst for that. But it would be good with HISA, and I'm not sure if HISA is doing this, but to reach out beyond America and maybe look at, you know, other countries within the umbrella of the IFHA, to really understand best practices, and maybe that could help with the policy setting.
I think, you know, this is the last question for me, but I think that's something else that could be drawn from the Hong Kong Jockey Club and from some other racing jurisdictions around the world is marketing and how well the sport is marketed. Now, you mentioned that Hong Kong is, but you're basically centralized. The Hong Kong Jockey Club runs everything, so I assume that helps. But you also talked about doing charity work and promotion in that way. What are some of the things right now that racing is doing well, you think, in America and marketing wise? And what are some of the things that are not being done well and that can be done better?
Well, not really sure, Joe. I mean, I would have to come back and really see what's going on. I know in marketing, the big days and the big events, big events like the Kentucky Derby and the Breeders' Cup, you know, they're pretty much on cruise control. But here, the difference here, I think, is, and this is the advantage of being relevant, is there's 88 race days a year, and every day is important, and every day gets super coverage in the media, which is something you don't see as much as you used to in the States. So, for example, tonight, it's a Tuesday night in Hong Kong. There's 8 races, and total wagering will be over 160 million US. So with that, you know, all of the newspapers in Hong Kong, circulation goes up on a race day. With that, I think what we tried to do here in the last decade or so is try to pull away from racing as a wagering activity and more as a sporting activity. And we've hooked up with World Horse Racing, along with Goodwood, Ascot, Breeders' Cup, and the VRC, Victoria Racing Club, and tried to really position racing at the elite level as a as a sport and really get away from the wagering side, but build up, you know, the athletes, whether it be horses, jockeys, trainers, whoever it might be, even grooms, to tell the story of what makes racing so great without the angle of wagering. Here, look, we do a lot of different things. You know, there are many big race days that, you know, one of the things, I guess, is always debated now is how much do you bundle up to have a big day? Bill just wrote about it, I think, the other day about Belmont Stakes Day. And you need that many races. Now, in Japan, they would never have more than one group one race on any race day. They'll have 12 races, but never have more than a group one. That's the Japanese way. Here, we'll have four group one races on Hong Kong International Race Day and three group ones on Champions Day. But that's as far as we go. Otherwise, there's really just one or two main events. But, you know, things like Ladies Day, Gentlemen's Bowtie Day, these are big days that we've been able to put together to get more into fashion lifestyle and really make sure that we can capture everybody. Happy Wednesday, you know, before COVID was such a happening event here on a Wednesday night where Happy Valley Racecourse owned Wednesday night in Hong Kong. It was it's not doing it the way they do it in England and have music after the races, which we don't like. We like the idea of taking that short window of 8 minutes, you know, before the horses really get in the parade ring and take that time. So the race goes official before the horses really assemble in the paddock, take that 8 minutes, have live music and have a vibe and an atmosphere where casual people who really may not even be interested in horse racing will get interested only because the environment is so contagious. And you're right on top of it at Happy Valley. You're right on top of the action. So you can't help but get drawn in. And so that's brought in an entirely different crowd, something we can't do at Sha Tin, but we can do at Happy Valley because of the location. So I think main thing is everybody to kind of think a little bit out of the box, but don't, you know, but also don't forget the main audience along the way and try to find that balance, because you're not going to grow unless you reach out and bring more people in. That also has to do with owners. I mean, we're careful about that. We have a very unique setup here where there's only so many permits that are awarded each year. A permit means you have a right to bring in a horse. And there might be 400 a year, but we'll have nearly 1,000 applications. But, you know, we're looking to make sure that we don't take that for granted, and we make sure that the next generation is coming in and showing interest in horse ownership. And we do everything we can to bring them along and educate them and hold their hand along the way. So, I think there's no magic in it. And I think, I think it's hard in the States to say, how do we really market a weekday of racing? And so they obviously gravitate to the big days, but it's something that really, again, best practices, you know, open your eyes. It's not a domestic game anymore. It's a global game. It's a global sport. Take a look at something that might be happening in Australia or Hong Kong or Japan or Europe and see if maybe there's something that triggers a thought that might work in the United States of America. So I think everybody needs to keep an open mind to it and try to find the right medicine that might work.
Well, Bill, congratulations on an incredible job at Hong Kong all these years. And America's racing can only be better bringing you back. So thanks for joining us, Bill. We appreciate the time.
Thanks very much.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Bill Nader will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by XBTV. This week's XBTV Workout of the Week features Smooth Like Straight. You're seeing right now, if you're watching the video portion, worked 4 furlongs and 48 and 4 last week at Santa Anita. The Michael McCarthy trainee was 3rd in this year's Grade 1 Maker's Mark Mile Stakes and 2nd in his last start in the Grade 1 Shoemaker Mile. This was his first work back since that start. Very admirable. You know, I think he's 5 now, getting a little up there, but hard-knocking turf horse, turf miler. Shows up every time. I don't think he's ever run out of the money, or at least he hasn't since his first couple of starts. Maybe at the Breeders' Cup he did. Either way, he shows up basically every single time and runs 1st, 2nd, or 3rd. Big check collector for the Michael McCarthy barn. Admirable horse. And also, we got Saratoga right around the corner. We're less than 3 weeks away now from Saratoga, if you can believe that. If you want to see all those works at the Oklahoma track, all those babies starting to get going for Saratoga, go to xbtv.com. Just type in the search bar. You can definitely find most of those horses, most of those babies, most of those stars that are pointing towards Saratoga. We cannot wait for that Saratoga meet just a couple weeks away. As we teased in the last segment, it wouldn't be a writer's room without a trainers behaving badly segment. And this is just, we're just going to talk about this real quick, but there was just a little bit of follow-up from the whole fallout with Peter Miller and Ruben Alvarado program training for Peter Miller over the winter at San Luis Rey. We talked about how ridiculous it was that Peter Miller only got a 7-day suspension by the Santa Anita stewards. They get a $10,000 fine. This week, Ruben Alvarado was suspended 14 days. And also Peter Miller got another fine, a fine on top of that, which was a separate incident for disorderly conduct, because he apparently was cursing out one of the vets at San Luis Rey who didn't want to take his horse off of the vet's list, which is a very classy thing to do, you know, just, you know, curse out the vet who's trying to protect the horse. You know, it's just one of those things where, what does this suspension do? Like, what does the Ruben Alvarado suspension do? He's 14 days at Los Alamitos when they're not really running horses anyway. And presumably he's going to go right back to assisting Peter Miller, who's, I think, kind of now at this point, a proven toxic person and a danger to horses based on his drug and his breakdown record. And the two of them will make hundreds of thousands of dollars this summer at Del Mar with the help of people like Gary Barber and Rockingham Ranch and whoever else funds Peter Miller's endeavors. And the wheels on the bus will continue to go round and round. And, you know, I have no idea if HISA or any kind of, you know, enforcement is going to do anything about this kind of shit. But, you know, if you can't get these kind of guys out of here, what really is the purpose of having, you know, any kind of uniform program? Because this is gross to me that Peter Miller and Ruben Alvarado did this, you know, basically deceive the betting public over months at a time. And it's just going to be business as usual for them this summer at Del Mar. Am I wrong, guys?
Well, no. And I'll just say what I said when the Miller suspension came out. You know, I don't know what the right number is for these guys, but for Ruben Alvarado, it's not 14 days. I mean, start talking about a year or something like that. And then, you know, I think the punishment will fit the crime. And Joe's, I think you've mentioned, we're talking about Miller, and I'll repeat that, is that, you know, what incentive does this give these guys to behave when, you know, that you do something fairly egregious here and you get a slap on the wrist? You know, where is the deterrent? You know, I'll just leave it at that. I'm not going to go into Peter Miller's whole record and his history and everything. But, you know, and the California Horse Racing Board surprised me, because I think usually they're pretty, you know, they can be fairly tough. I mean, not always, but they can be. I don't know how they came up with just 14 days for these guys. That is a slap in the face to, you know, the bettors more so than anything else. You know, look, I mean, probably the bettors were, we know Miller's really training behind the scenes. But nonetheless, you know, you're telling the bettors that Ruben Alvarado was the trainer of these horses, and he wasn't. It was Peter Miller. You know, that's pretty serious stuff. So, you know, 14 days, I'll just say he should have been suspended. Both of them should have been suspended at least a year.
Yeah, and you know, when you look up the term classless trainer in the dictionary, you see Peter Miller's face. And that's actually a really tough call, because there's a lot of trainers that could be the poster child for classless trainers. But here's a guy who time and time again has been verbally abusive, not only to vets, but to other trainers, to officials. I remember correctly, guys, correct me if I'm wrong, but like, wasn't there a horse that he campaigned in a number of Breeders' Cup races, and then he got into a fight with the owner because one of them wanted to continue to campaign the horse, and the other one didn't, and there was, you know, like public verbal, you know, barrages Stormy going Liberal. Back and forth. Right? Was that
Stormy Liberal was the horse?
Stormy Liberal, right. Who all the horse did was make 7 figures for everyone involved, and yep. And kind of got in the middle of all this kind of public nonsense. But you know, you look at a guy like that and you say, why are we allowing to continue to have people like that represent our sport or be involved in the industry, when you know that they just can't help themselves, that they're going to do the wrong thing. And look, I know like Charles Barkley was famous about saying, I'm an athlete, I'm not a role model. And certainly we shouldn't be, you know, having our children look at a lot of these trainers and say, that's what I want you to be like, because they're just not, it's not a good fit for a lot of people. There are a lot of great trainers, don't get me wrong, and they're quality people. But in this case, he's not one of them. Peter Miller has shown time and time again that he's just not a good guy. And I'm sure that I'll get confronted by him, you know, the next time I see him at a sale or anything like that. And that'll just play right into it. But the bottom line is, like, is it that we have a toothless system where 14 days is the max that we can give somebody like that? I honestly don't know. Because as we just alluded to in the Baffert, you know, segment, somebody can do something egregiously wrong against the system and can continue to get a plea down and get time served, as we get the hearings, going further and further down the chain. So I'm really hoping, and maybe I'm just being Pollyanna, but I'm really hoping that HISA is going to continue to rectify our industry in the long run, because in the short run, it's a cluster crap right now, you know, as far as what's going on the edge of having HISA, you know, be implemented in a couple of days. But man, I would love to see, again, I'm not an attorney. I would love to see though, just how much, how many days or the extent of the fines and suspensions that can be given for a situation like this, because this is not a one-off. This is not a one-off. And I think, if I remember correctly, the reason why Peter Miller didn't get a harsher penalty prior to this is because he, quote unquote, retired for 6 months. Obviously, his retirement didn't relax him at all.
Yeah, right. Yeah, just did not enough time to pursue his personal well-being and his mental health or whatever the fuck he said that let him, you know, skate for 6 months and then come while he was train for 6 months, you know, in secret for Ruben Alvarado, and then come back and serve 7 days and just have everything be back to normal for this summer and this fall. But yeah, like, that's the point, John, is he's representing our industry. He is a top trainer. He's a top five trainer in California. He's not a nobody. He's a guy that is a high profile trainer. Like you said, has trained Breeders' Cup winners, has trained champions. And he just has proven time and time again, he is not the kind of person that should be one of the standard bearers for horse racing. And I don't know how, you know, people in racing and especially his owners reconcile that. Like, I get that he wins a lot of races for you, but, you know, over and over again, he's proven that he's incapable of, you know, honestly and forthrightly and, you know, being a classy representative of the sport. He doesn't do it. And he's, like I said, forgetting even the drug and the breakdown record. He's dangerous to horses. Just his personal behavior, you know, cursing out a vet. And there's been a bunch of stuff like that with him in the past. Why is he one of the top representatives of our sport? And why don't we have the wherewithal to get guys like that out of here? Would racing be that worse off if, you know, Peter Miller were replaced by some honest trainer in the standings? No, I think it would be much better. But, you know, there's just either no appetite or no wherewithal, like I said, to go after guys like this, unfortunately. I promise after this commercial, we're going to talk about racing again. It's not just going to be us bitching and moaning about trainers that we don't think are representing the sport well. We got some racing to talk about. It's a big racing weekend. Stephen Foster got a couple races at Belmont. So that's coming up after this break. But in the meantime, the TDN Writers Room is brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds. Earlier this month, West Point Stone Silent was the first two-year-old winner this year for West Point with an exciting debut victory in the Facek Tipton Debutante Stakes. This year's group of West Point two-year-olds includes 39 colts and 23 fillies. 39 and 20, that's 62 two-year-olds. We saw them buying up big at the Keeneland September sale. We saw them at the two-year-old sales, obviously. So tons of action coming this summer for West Point with the babies. And the countdown is on right now for West Point's 1,000th win. Right now they're at 993. They have several entries in for this weekend. So best of luck to the West Point partners this weekend and the rest of the summer. Really looking forward to seeing all those babies on the track, Saratoga, and maybe a little bit at Del Mar. So we'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up and down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business can benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. Last week, Legacy Bloodstock reached $140 million in sales grad earnings. That's a pretty damn big number for a small shop. So congratulations to Tommy and Wendy and all of their sales grads. The entry deadline for the Facing Tipton October sale is July 15th. Legacy has exceeded the sales average at 11 past Facing Tipton October sales, and also obviously the Facing July sales right around the corner. We're getting into yearling sales season, so definitely hit up Tommy or Wendy. They will do right by your horse, and best of luck to you guys coming up this summer and fall. All right, so we promised a little bit of racing talk. I'm a man of my word. We took a little while to get to it, but we do have, this is kind of the last big weekend before Saratoga comes up. We got the Stephen, actually, no, that's not true, because don't we have the Belmont Turf races the weekend after? Yeah, so we actually have some good action the next two weekends. But this weekend we have the Stephen Foster card on Saturday at Churchill. This is closing weekend at Churchill Downs, runs through July 4th, which is Monday. And then we also have the John Nayrud and a couple stakes at Belmont. That's interesting because it's going to be a matchup of Life is Good against Speaker's Corner, which is, you know, other than Flightline, I think those are the two best one-turn horses in America right now. So it's going to be interesting to see those two clash. And we have a good field in the Stephen Foster. It's honestly a pretty star-studded field now. It's no longer a grade one. Used to be a grade one for a long time. It's a grade two now. We've got Olympiad, who's my boy, obviously, facing off with Mandaloon, and American Revolution is supposed to be in there as well, who I think we haven't seen since last year, but he was an up-and-coming, very, very nice horse for Todd Pletcher and Windstar. So that's what I'm looking forward to. We got the Stephen Foster card and the John Nayrud. But also one of the subplots of this weekend is they were supposed to have turf racing for this weekend at Churchill Downs. If you know that, Churchill has had problems with this turf course. It's an all-new turf course for this year, and they've had issues where they haven't been able to run on it for the last couple of weeks. They were supposed to be able to run on it for this weekend. They had the Grade 2 Wise Dan scheduled for the turf. That race has been canceled, and the other turf stakes for the weekend are going to have been moved to the main track. So that's an ongoing subplot, whether or not this Churchill Downs turf course is ever going to be ready. That to me is something to watch, I think, for the fall meet. I assume it's going to be ready by then. They spent a lot of money on this turf course. If they don't get it right by then, you might have to rip the whole thing up. That's my thoughts. What are you guys looking forward to this weekend?
I mean, Life is Good. And Joe, you know, we forget after he just thrashed Nick's Go in the Pegasus, we were talking about him like we kind of talk about Flightline now. Now, he stubbed his toe since then, running fourth in the Dubai World Cup. You know, maybe the trip over there got to him. Maybe the mile and a quarter was a little bit beyond his range. But, you know, if he comes back, beats Speaker's Corner and looks like the Life is Good that, you know, was just sensational in that race back in January, Gulfstream. You know, by the way, here we go again. You know, we're getting in, it's July, and he's making his third start of the year, you know, and in what is by modern standards, pretty full campaign, actually. That's what I'm looking forward to. It. And, you know, and you're not going to have him go against a bunch of tomato cans because you do have Speaker's Corner in there. So, you know, he's going to be tested. I'm really looking forward to see what he does. I guess the Whitney would be next, but this is going to be, you know, a race to see where he comes back. You know, it's a shame with the Churchill Turf course, but they had to take the Wise Dan. They couldn't move it to the dirt because then it's the same race as the Stephen Foster.
Right.
They have the exact same races, a big run. So they did take the other turf races and move them to the dirt, but you can see why they weren't able to run the Wise Dan.
But what would you consider your definition of a tomato can would be in a race like this?
A not very good horse. What kind of question?
It's called a leading question. It's a leading question. Okay. And it's because, you know, there's three other horses that are proposed to be in the race. One was a $40,000 claimer. One's a two other than, and one's a horse that Uriah St. Louis, God bless him, is bringing in because he always has a horse running in these races. Cause he actually does you know, fill the fourth or fifth spot in the majority of the races. And every now and then he does jump up and win one. So I would say that the majority of horses in the Nehrud are tomato cans in accordance with what you were saying. But the match race is really, you know, if you take those out, it's Speaker's Corner against Life is Good, which is awesome, which is going to be really
so fun. What you're telling me is they're not going to have an 11 horse field, huh, John?
They're not going to have an 11 horse
field.
All great
stakes horses.
And that majority of them are going to be tomato cans to use your term, which would be a great name for a horse if we hadn't just tainted it by saying how that really is bad. The Stephen Foster looks like it's going to be a great race. You guys have already gone through that. But lest we forget the baby races that are being run at Churchill Downs, not on the turf, obviously. But we have, you know, the debutante stake with our horse Wonder Wheel. And most importantly, and we'll finish on this, most importantly, we have Stay on Her Good Side. Yes, our favorite horse here, other than Writer's Room, Stay on Her Good Side will be running in the Bashful Manor. And I have it on very, very good information that superfan Skip Anderson is actually going to be flying in and making a debut and an appearance to represent us in those stake races. So Skip, wear your lucky underwear, because if you don't win one of these two races, you're never allowed to come back, buddy. But we look forward to seeing you there. And also superfan Stephanie said that she's actually going to try to get there as well. So we are going to be well represented for the Bashful Manor. And hopefully we'll see their smiling faces in the winner's circle picture.
Hell yeah. Yeah. Skip hit me up and said that he would be there this weekend. Yeah. Shout out to Skip and Steph. And yes, hopefully Skip is a good luck charm, because I don't think he's going to be at Saratoga this summer because of this. So have fun, Skip, and best of luck to Stay on Her Good Side. And John mentioned her, and I don't want to wrap before we say that Writer's Room, I thought, had an encouraging debut. I thought she, you know, she dropped back early and she was lagging towards the back of the field. I don't know if we have the video that we can show of her flying down the track to have the most consequential electric fourth place finish in racing history. I don't think that's hyperbole, frankly. But no, she finished up well. She just missed second. She had like a couple jumps away from getting up for second. She completed the super. She was fourth. Going to be interesting to see. I think she'll stretch out next, John was saying, at Saratoga this summer. So hopefully maybe there'll be a New York bred two turn Saratoga maiden special weight on the turf for when I'm there, you know, something in the finish.
July 16th is going to be New York bred maiden special.
Go. Listen, I'll be there.
Going a mile and 16th on the turf, and that's where Writer's Room is going to hopefully make her next race. So just like you mentioned, Joe, like our show together, like our chemistry together, it was clunky and a little little nervousy and not that great in the beginning. But man, when we started getting it going, we came flying down the lane and looked like we're going to be a success. So Writer's Room is basically, you know, embodying our relationship between the three of us over the past 2+ years.
Yeah, once we figured out how our legs worked, we really got cooking. Came home at 23.05, and I will be there that Saturday at Saratoga, July 16th. So yes, please, Linda, do not scratch. Please run the horse in that race. I know how you love to scratch, but yeah, I can't wait to see her, and it was really, really exciting seeing her on Saturday. So thanks to everybody who sent good wishes and good luck and all that stuff. And we're looking forward to Stay on Her Good Side on Monday. Maybe if he wins the race, John will learn that the name of the race is the Bashford Manor.
Mm-hmm. What do I call it?
Bashful Manor for weeks now. We haven't corrected him.
I'm sorry. That makes more sense. That makes more sense.
So when we send you the trophy, when Stay on Her Good Side wins, I don't want you to be surprised.
Yes.
That's what the stakes name is.
I would send it back. I'd be like, no, it's the Bashful Manor, obviously.
Is it the Bashful Manor trophy?
Yes. It's where all the seven dwarfs live, in the Bashful Manor, right? It's Sleepy and Dopey and Doc and Bashful. And, you know, that makes much more sense. I'm sorry. I've been slandering the Bashford Manor for months and months and months. And I appreciate either you guys didn't want to correct me or didn't even care. Didn't even listen to me at this point. Exactly. A little known secret that when Joe Bianca actually watches the podcast, he actually fast forwards to only when he actually is talking. He doesn't listen to what what Bill and I say, you know, and I don't blame him. I can't argue with that. But that's a little known fact.
I mean, I have to hear you once, John. Why would I go back and have to hear you twice in the same day? Come on. Holy human. Before we get out of here, of course, we got this week's Remy cartoon. It's a UFO coming down with a horse saying, I'll make you a deal. I won't destroy your planet and you give me a season to curl in. I don't know. Would Hale and Dale really give up that season to save the planet? Probably would. I mean, that's how valuable Curlin is these days. He's just an absolute monster. But yo, shout out to Remy. Not a bad deal. All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. This was fun, guys. I enjoyed this one. Keeneland's September sale begins Monday, September 12th. You can learn more at theworldsyearlingsale.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, Bill Nader, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Petruniak, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. Have a happy 4th. We'll see you next week.